Books filled this room, too. That was the first impression, one of dank, oppressive bookishness. The late Father Tubelcheck was sprawled across a drift of fallen books. He was certainly dead. No one could have bled that much and still been alive, or survived for long with a head like a deflated football. Someone must have hit him with a lump hammer.
"This old lady came running out screaming," said Constable Visit, saluting. "So I went in, and it was just like this, sir."
"Just like this, Constable Visit?"
"Yes, sir, and the name's Visit the Infidel with explanatory pamphlets, sir."
"Who was the old lady?"
"She says she's Mrs. Kanaki, sir. She says she always brings him his meals. She says she does for him."
"Does for him?"
"You know, sir, cleaning and sweeping."
There was indeed a tray on the floor, along with a broken bowl and some spilled porridge. The lady who did for the old man had been shocked to find that someone else had done for him first.
"Did she touch him?" he said.
"She says not, sir."
Which meant the old priest had somehow achieved the neatest death Vimes had ever seen. His hands were crossed on his chest, his eyes had been closed. And something had been put in his mouth. It looked like a rolled-up piece of paper. It gave the corpse a disconcertingly jaunty look, as though he'd decided to have a last cigarette after dying. Vimes gingerly picked out the little scroll and unrolled it. It was covered with meticulously written but unfamiliar symbols. What made them particularly noteworthy was the fact that their author had apparently made use of the only liquid lying around in huge quantities.
"Yuck," said Vimes. "Written in blood. Does this mean anything to anyone?"
"Yes, sir."
Vimes rolled his eyes.
"Yes, Constable Visit."
"Visit the Infidel with explanatory pamphlets, sir," said Constable Visit, looking hurt.
"The Infidel with explanatory pamphlets."
Constable Visit was an Omnian, whose country's traditional approach to evangelism was to put unbelievers to torture and the sword. Things had become a lot more civilized these days, but Omnians still had a strenuous and indefatigable approach to spreading the word, and had merely changed the nature of the weapons. Constable Visit spent his days off in company with his co-religious smite the unbeliever with cunning arguments, ringing doorbells and causing people to hide behind the furniture everywhere in the city.
"I was just about to say it, Constable," said Vimes.
"Well?" "It's an ancient Clachian script," said Constable Visit. "One of the desert tribes called it the Cenotines, sir. They had a sophisticated but fundamentally flawed..."
"Yes, yes, yes," said Vimes, who could recognise the verbal foot getting ready to stick itself in the oral door.
"But do you know what it means?"
"I could find out, sir."
"Good.
Incidentally, were you able by any chance to find time to have a look at those leaflets I gave you the other day, sir?"
Been very busy," said Vimes automatically.
"Not to worry, sir," said Visit, and smiled the wan smile of those doing good against great odds. "When you've got a moment, we'll be fine."
The old books that had been knocked from the shelves had spilled their pages everywhere. There were splashes of blood on many of them.
"Some of these look religious," Vimes said. "You might find something."
He turned.
"Detritus, have a look round, will you?"
Detritus paused in the act of laboriously drawing a chalk line around the body.
"Yes, sir. What for, sir?"
"Anything you find."
"Right, sir."
With a grunt, Vimes hunkered down and prodded at a grey smear on the floor.
"Dirt," he said.
"You get dirt on floors, sir,"
said Detritus helpfully.
"Except this is off-white. We're on black loam," said Vimes.
"Ah," said Sergeant Detritus. "A clue."
"Could just be dirt, of course."
There was something else. Someone had made an attempt to tidy up the books. They'd stacked several dozen of them in one neat towering pile, one book wide, largest books on the bottom, all the edges squared up with geometrical precision.
"Now that I don't understand," said Vimes. "There's a fight, the old man is viciously attacked, then someone, maybe it was him, dying, maybe it was the murderer, writes something down using the poor man's own blood, and rolls it up neatly and pops it into his mouth like a sweetie. Then he does die, and someone shuts his eyes and makes him tidy and pile these books up neatly, and does what? Walks out into the seething hurly-burly that is Ankh-Morpork?"
Sergeant Detritus's honest brow furrowed with the effort of thought.
"Could be, "Could be there's a footprint outside the window," he said. "That's always a clue worth looking for."
Vimes sighed. Detritus, despite a room-temperature IQ, made a good copper and a damn good sergeant. He had that special type of stupidity that was hard to fool. But the only thing more difficult than getting him to grasp an idea was getting him to let go of it. Detritus was particularly good when it came to asking questions. He had three basic ones. They were the direct, "Did you do it?" the persistent, "Are you sure it wasn't you what done it?" and the subtle, "It was you what done it, wasn't it?" Although they were not the most cunning questions ever devised, Detritus's talent was to go on patiently asking them for hours on end until he got the right answer, which was generally something like, "Yes, yes, I did it, now please tell me what it was I did." "Detritus," he said, as kindly as possible, "there's a 30-foot drop into the river outside the window. There won't be..." He paused. This was the River Ankh, after all. "Any footprints would be bound to have oozed back by now," he corrected himself, "almost certainly." He looked outside, though, just in case. The river gurgled and sucked below him. There were no footprints, even on its famously crusted surface. There was another smear of dirt on the windowsill. Vimes scratched some up and sniffed at it. "Looks like some more white clay," he said. He couldn't think of any white clay around the city. Once you got outside the walls, it was thick black loam all the way to the ramtops. A man walking across it would be 2 inches taller by the time he got to the other side of a field. "White clay," he said. "Where the hell is white clay country round here?"
"It's a mystery," said Detritus.
Vimes grinned mirthlessly. It was a mystery, and he didn't like mysteries. Mysteries had a way of getting bigger if you didn't solve them quickly. Mysteries pupped. Mere murders happened all the time, and usually even Detritus could solve them. When a distraught woman was standing over a fallen husband holding a right-angled poker and crying, "He never should have said that about our Neville," there was only a limited amount you could do to spin out the case beyond the next coffee break. And when various men or parts thereof were hanging from or nailed to various fixtures in the mended drum on a Saturday night, and the other clientele were all looking innocent, you didn't even need a detritic intelligence to work out what had been happening. He looked down at the late Father Tubelcheck. It was amazing he'd bled so much, with his pipe-cleaner arms and toast-racked chest. He certainly wouldn't have been able to put up much of a fight. Vimes leaned down and gently raised one of the corpse's eyelids. A milky blue eye with a black centre looked back at him from wherever the old priest was now. A religious old man, who lived in a couple of little pokey rooms, and obviously didn't go out much from the smell. What kind of threat could he... Constable Visit poked his head around the door. "There's a dwarf down here with no eyebrows and a frizzled beard. Says you told him to come, sir," he said. "And some citizens say Father Tubelcheck is their priest, and they want to bury him decently."
"Ah, that'll be Little Bottom. Send him up," said Vimes, straightening. "Tell the others they'll have to wait."
Little Bottom climbed the stairs, took in the scene, and managed to reach the window in time to be sick.
"Better now?" said Vimes eventually.
Yes, I hope so."
"I'll leave you to it, then."
What exactly did you want me to do?"
said Little Bottom. But Vimes was already halfway down the stairs. Angua growled. It was the signal to Carrot that he could open his eyes again. Women, as Colon had remarked to Carrot once when he thought the lad needed advice, could be funny about little things. Maybe they didn't like to be seen without their makeup on, or insisted on buying smaller suitcases than men, even though they always took more clothes. In Angua's case, she didn't like to be seen en route from human to werewolf shape or vice versa. It was just something she had a thing about, she said. Carrot could see her in either shape, but not in the various ones she occupied on the way through, in case he never wanted to see her again. Through werewolf eyes, the world was different. For one thing, it was in black and white. At least, that small part of it which as a human she thought of as vision was monochrome. But who cared that vision had to take a back seat when smell drove instead, laughing and sticking its arm out of the window and making rude gestures at all the other senses? Afterwards, she always remembered the odours as colours and sounds. Blood was rich brown and deep base. Stale bread was a surprisingly tinkly bright blue, and every human being was a four-dimensional kaleidoscopic symphony. For nasal vision meant seeing through time as well as space. A man could stand still for a minute, and an hour later there'd still be, to the nose, his odours, barely faded. She prowled the aisles of the Dwarf Bread Museum, muzzled to the ground. Then she went out into the alley for a while and tried there too. After 5 minutes she padded back to Carrot and gave him the signal again. When he reopened his eyes, she was pulling her shirt on over her head. That was one thing where humans had the edge. You couldn't beat a pair of hands.
"I thought you'd be down the street and following someone," he said.
"Follow who?" said Angua.
"Pardon? I can smell him, and you, and the bread, and that's it."
"Nothing else?
Dirt, dust, the usual stuff? Oh, there are some old traces, days old. I know you were in here last week, for example. There are lots of smells. Grease, meat, pine resin for some reason, old food. But I'll swear no living thing's been in here in the last day or so but him and us."
"But you told me everyone leaves a trail."
"They do."
Carrot looked down at the late curator. However you phrased it, however broadly you applied your definitions, he definitely couldn't have committed suicide. Not with a loaf of bread.
"Vampires?" said Carrot. "They can fly."
Angua sighed.
"Carrot, I could tell if a vampire had been in here in the last month."
"Well, there's almost half a dollar in pennies in the drawer," said Carrot. "Anyway, a thief would be here for the battle bread, wouldn't they? It is a very valuable cultural artifact."
"Has the poor man got any relatives?" said Angua.
"He's got an elderly sister, I believe. Come in once a month just to have a chat. He lets me handle the exhibits, you know."
"That must be fun," said Angua, before she could stop herself.
"It's very satisfying."
"Yes," said Carrot solemnly. "It reminds me of home."
Angua sighed and stepped into the room behind the little museum. It was like the back rooms of museums everywhere, full of junk and things there is no room for on the shelves, and also items of doubtful provenance, such as coins dated 52 BC. There were some benches with shards of dwarf bread on them, a tidy tool rack with various sizes of kneading hammer, and papers all over the place. Against one wall, and occupying a large part of the room, was an oven.
"He researches old recipes," said Carrot, who seemed to feel he had to promote the old man's expertise even in death.
Angua opened the oven door. Warmth spilt out into the room.
"Hell of a bake oven," she said. "What are these things?"
"Ah, I see he's been making drop scones," said Carrot. "Quite deadly at short range."
She shut the door.
"Let's go back to the yard and they can send someone out to..."
Angua stopped. These were always the dangerous moments, just after a shape change this close to full moon. It wasn't so bad when she was a wolf. She was still as intelligent, or at least she felt as intelligent, although life was a lot simpler, and so she was probably just extremely intelligent for a wolf. It was when she became a human again that things were difficult. For a few minutes, until the morphic field fully reasserted itself, all her senses were still keen. Smells were still incredibly strong, and her ears could hear sounds way outside the stunted human range. And she could think more about the things she experienced. A wolf could sniff a lamppost and know that old Bonzo had been passed yesterday and was feeling a bit under the weather and was still being fed tripe by his owner, but a human mind could actually think about the whys and wherefores.
"There is something else," she said, and breathed in gently. "Faint. Not a living thing, but can't you smell it? Something like dirt, but not quite. It's kind of yellow-orange."
Said Carrot tactfully, "some of us don't have your nose." "I've smelled it before, somewhere in this town. I can't remember where. It's strong, stronger than the other smells. It's a muddy smell."
"Ha! Well, on these streets..."
"No, no, it's not exactly mud. Sharper, more treble. You know, sometimes I envy you. It must be nice to be a wolf just for a while."
"It has its drawbacks."
"Like fleas," she thought, as they locked up the museum. "And the food, and the constant nagging feeling that you should be wearing three bras at once." She kept telling herself she had it under control, and she did, in a way. She prowled the city on moonlit nights, and, okay, there was the occasional chicken, but she always remembered where she'd been, and went round next day to shove some money under the door. It was hard to be a vegetarian who had to pick bits of meat out of her teeth in the morning. She was definitely on top of it, though. Definitely. She reassured herself. It was Angua's mind that prowled the night, not a werewolf mind. She was almost entirely sure of that. A werewolf wouldn't stop at chickens, not by a long way. She shuddered. Who was she kidding? It was easy to be a vegetarian by day. It was preventing yourself from becoming a humanitarian at night that took the real effort. The first clocks were striking 11 as Vimes's sedan chair wobbled to a halt outside the Patrician's palace. Commander Vimes's legs were beginning to give out, but he ran up 5 flights of stairs as fast as possible and collapsed on a chair in the waiting salon. Minutes went past. You didn't knock on the Patrician's door. He summoned you in the certain knowledge that you would be there. Vimes sat back, enjoying a moment's peace. Something inside his coat went bing, bing, bingly, bing. He sighed, pulled out a leather-bound package about the size of a small book, and opened it. A friendly yet slightly worried face peered up at him from its cage. Yes, said Vimes.
11 a.m. Appointment with the Patrician.
Yes. Well, it's 5 past now.
So you've had it, have you?
Said the imp. No.
Shall I go on remembering it, or what?
No. Anyway, you didn't remind me about the College of Arms at 10. The imp looked panic-stricken.
That's Tuesday, isn't it? Could have sworn it was Tuesday.
It was an hour ago.
Oh.
The imp was downcast.
Oh, all right, sorry. Hey, could I tell you what time it is in Klatch, if you like? Or Genua? Or Hung Hung? Any of those places. You name it.
I don't need to know the time in Klatch.
You might, said the imp desperately. Think how people would be impressed if, during a dull moment of the conversation, you could say, incidentally, in Klatch, it's an hour ago. Or Besh Pelagic. Or Ephebe. Ask me. Go on, go on. I don't mind. Any of those places.
Vimes sighed inwardly. He had a notebook. He took notes in it. It was always useful. And then Sybil, God bless her, had brought him this 15-function imp which did so many other things, although as far as he could see at least 10 of its functions consisted of apologising for its inefficiency in the other 5. You could take a memo, Vimes said.
Wow! Really? Gosh, okay. Right. No problem.
Vimes cleared his throat. See Corporal Nobbs re-timekeeping, also re-earldom.
Is this the memo?
Yes.
Sorry, you should have said memo first. I'm pretty certain it's in the manual.
All right, it was a memo.
Sorry, you have to say it again.
Memo. See Corporal Nobbs re-timekeeping, also re-earldom.
Got it,
said the imp.
Would you like to be reminded of this at any particular time?
The time here, said Vimes nastily, or the time in, say, Klatch.
As a matter of fact, I can tell you what time it...
I think I'll write in my notebook, if you don't mind, said Vimes.
Well, if you prefer. I can recognise handwriting,
said the imp proudly.
I'm quite advanced.
Vimes pulled out his notebook and held it up. Like this, he said. The imp squinted for a moment.
Yep, it said. That's handwriting, sure enough. Curly bits, spiky bits, all joined together. Yep, handwriting. I'd recognise it anywhere.
Aren't you supposed to tell me what it says? The imp looked wary.
Says?
He said.
It's supposed to make noises.
Vimes put the battered book away and shut the lid of the organiser. Then he sat back and carried on waiting. Someone very clever, certainly someone much cleverer than whoever had trained that imp, must have made the clock for the Patrician's waiting room. It went tick-tock like any other clock. But somehow, and against all usual horological practice, the tick and the tock were irregular. Tick, tock, tick, and then the merest fraction of a second longer before, tock, tick, tock, and then a tick a fraction of a second earlier than the mind's ear was now prepared for. The effect was enough, after 10 minutes, to reduce the thinking processes of even the best prepared to a sort of porridge. The Patrician must have paid the clockmaker quite highly. The clock said 11:15. Vimes walked over to the door and, despite precedent, knocked gently. There was no sound from within, no murmur of distant voices. He tried the handle. The door was unlocked. Lord Vetinari had always said that punctuality was the politeness of princes. Vimes went in. Cheery dutifully scraped up the crumbly white dirt and then examined the corpse of the late Father Tubalcheck. Anatomy was an important study at the Alchemists' Guild, owing to the ancient theory that the human body represented a microcosm of the universe, although when you saw one opened up it was hard to imagine which part of the universe was small and purple and went blomp blomp when you prodded it. But in any case, you tended to pick up practical anatomy as you went along, and sometimes scraped it off the walls as well. When new students tried an experiment that was particularly successful in terms of explosive force, the result was often a cross between a major laboratory refit and a game of hunt the other kidney. The man had been killed by being repeatedly hit around the head. That was about all you could say. Some kind of very heavy, blunt instrument. It is a pervasive and beguiling myth that the people who design instruments of death end up being killed by them. There is almost no foundation, in fact. Colonel Shrapnel wasn't blown up. Monsieur Guillotine died with his head on. Colonel Gatling wasn't shot. If it hadn't been for the murder of Kosh and blackjack maker Sir William Blunt Instrument in an alleyway, the rumour would never have got started. What else did Vimes expect Cheery to do? He looked carefully at the rest of the body. There were no other obvious signs of violence, although there were a few specks of blood on the man's fingers, but then there was blood everywhere. A couple of fingernails were torn. Tubalcheck had put up a fight, or at least had tried to shield himself with his hands. Cheery looked more closely at the fingers. There was something piled under the nails. It had a waxy sheen, like thick grease. He couldn't imagine why it should be there, but maybe his job was to find out. He conscientiously took an envelope out of his pocket and scraped the stuff into it, sealed it up and numbered it. Then he took his iconograph out of its box and prepared to take a picture of the corpse. As he did so, something caught his eye. Father Tubalcheck lay there, one eye still open, as Vimes had left it, winking at eternity. Cheery looked closer. He thought he'd imagined it, but even now he wasn't sure. The mind could play tricks. He opened the little door of the iconograph and spoke to the imp inside.
"Can you paint a picture of his eye, Sidney?"
he said. The imp squinted out through the lens.
"Just the eye?"
it squeaked.
"Yes, as big as you can." "You're sick, mister." "And shut up," said Cheery.
He propped the box on the table and sat back. From inside the box there came the swish-swish of brush strokes. At last there was the sound of a handle being turned and a slightly damp picture rustled out of a slot. Cheery peered at it. Then he knocked on the box. The hatch opened.
"Yes?" "Bigger. So big it fills the whole paper. In fact,"
Cheery squinted at the picture in his hands,
"just paint the pupil, the bit in the middle." "So it fills the whole paper? You're weird."
Cheery propped the box nearer. There was a clicking of gears as the imp wound the lenses out, and then a few more seconds of busy brushwork. Another damp picture unwound. It showed a big black disc. Well, mainly black. Cheery looked closer. There was a hint, just a hint. He rapped on the box again.
"Yes, Mr. Dwarf Weird Person,"
said the imp.
"The bit in the middle, big as you can, thank you."
The lenses wound out yet further. Cheery waited anxiously. In the next room he could hear detritus patiently moving around. The paper wound out for the third time, and the hatch opened.
"That's it," said the imp. "I've run out of black."
And the paper was black. Except for the tiny little area that wasn't. The door to the stairs burst open and Constable Visit came in, borne along by the pressure of a small crowd. Cheery guiltily thrust the paper into his pocket.
"This is intolerable," said a small man with a long black beard. "We demand you let us in. Who are you, young man?"
I'm Corporal Littlebottom," said Cheery. "Look, I've got a badge."
"Well, Corporal," said the man, "I am Wengel Radley, and I'm a man of some standing in this community, and I demand that you let us have poor Father Tubalcheck this minute."
"Well, we're trying to find out who killed him," Cheery began.
There was a movement behind Cheery, and the faces in front of him suddenly looked very worried indeed. He turned to see detritus in the doorway to the next room.
"Everything okay?" said the troll.
The changed fortunes of the watch had allowed Detritus to have a proper breastplate, rather than a piece of elephant battle armour. As was normal practice for the uniform of a sergeant, the armourer had attempted to do a stylized representation of muscles on it. As far as Detritus was concerned, he hadn't been able to get them all in.
"Is there any trouble?" he said.
The crowd backed away.
"None at all, officer," said Mr. Radley. "You were just loomed suddenly, that's all."
"That's correct," said Detritus. "I am a loomer. It often happens suddenly, so there's no trouble, then?"
"No trouble whatsoever, officer."
"Amazing thing, trouble," rumbled Detritus thoughtfully. "Always I go looking for trouble, and when I find it, people say it ain't there."
Mr. Radley drew himself up.
"But we want to take Father Tuplechek away to bury him," he said.
Detritus turned to cheery Littlebottom.
"You done everything you need?"
"I suppose so."
"He dead?"
"Oh, yes."
"You gonna get any better?"
"Better than dead, I doubt it."
"Okay, then, you people can take him away."
The two watchmen stood aside as the body was carried down the stairs.
"Why are you taking pictures of the dead man?" said Detritus.
"Well, it might be helpful to see how he was lying."
Detritus nodded sagely.
"Ah, he was lying, was he? And him a holy man, too?"
Littlebottom pulled out the picture and looked at it again. It was almost black. But a constable arrived at the bottom of the stairs.
"Is there someone up there called—"
There was a muffled snigger.
"Cheery Littlebottom?"
"Yes," said Littlebottom gloomily.
"Well, Commander Vimes says you've got to come to the Patrician's Palace right now, all right?" "That's Corporal Littlebottom you're talking to," said Detritus.
"It's all right," said Littlebottom. "Nothing could make it any worse."
Rumour is information distilled so finely that it can filter through anything. It does not need doors and windows. Sometimes it doesn't even need people. It can exist free and wild, running from ear to ear, without ever touching lips. It had escaped already. From the high window of the patrician's bedroom, Sam Vimes could see people drifting towards the palace. There wasn't a mob, there wasn't even what you might call a crowd, but the Brownian motion of the streets was bouncing more and more people in his direction. He relaxed slightly when he saw one or two guards come through the gates. On the bed, Lord Vetinari opened his eyes.
"Ah, Commander Vimes," he murmured.
"What's been happening, sir?" said Vimes.
"I appear to be lying down, Vimes."
"You were in your office, sir, unconscious."
"Dear me, I must have been overdoing it. Well, thank you. If you would be kind enough to help me up."
Lord Vetinari tried to pull himself upright, swayed and fell back again. His face was pale. Sweat beaded his forehead. There was a knock at the door. Vimes opened it a fraction.
"It's me, sir. Fred Colan. I got a message. What's up?"
"Ah, Fred. Who have you got down there so far?"
"There's me and Constable Flint and Constable Slapper, sir."
"Right. Someone's to go up to my place and get Willikins to bring me my street uniform and my sword and crossbow and an overnight bag and some cigars. And they'll just have to tell Lady Sybil I've got to deal with things down here, that's all."
"What's happening, sir? Someone downstairs said Lord Vetinari's dead."
"Dead?" murmured the patrician from his bed. "Nonsense!"
He jerked himself upright, swung his legs off the bed, and folded up. It was a slow, terrible collapse. Lord Vetinari was a tall man, so there was a long way to fall, and he did it by folding up a joint at a time. His ankles gave way, and he fell on his knees. His knees hit the ground with a bang, and he bent at the waist. Finally, his forehead bounced on the carpet.
"Oh," he said. "His lordship's just a bit,
Vimes began, then he grabbed Colon and dragged him out of the room.
"I reckon he's been poisoned, Fred, and that's the truth of it."
Colon looked horrified.
"Ye gods, do you want me to get a doctor? Are you mad? We want him to live."
Vimes bit his lip. He'd said the words that were on his mind, and now, without a doubt, the faint smoke of rumour would drift out across the city.
"But someone ought to look at him," he said aloud.
"Damn right," said Colon. "You want I should get a wizard?
How do we know it wasn't one of them?"
"Ye gods!"
Vimes tried to think. All the doctors in the city were employed by the guilds, and all the guilds hated veterinari, so...
"When you've got enough people to spare a runner, send him up to the stables on King's Down to fetch Donut Jimmy," he said.
Colon looked even more stricken.
"Donut? He doesn't know anything about doctoring. He dopes racehorses. Just get him, Fred."
"What if he won't come?"
"Then say that Commander Vimes knows why Laughing Boy didn't win the Quirm $100 last week, and say that I know Chryso Praise the Troll lost 10,000 on that race."
Colon was impressed.
"You've got a nasty twist of mind there, sir. There's going to be a lot of people turning up pretty soon. I want a couple of watchmen outside this room, trolls or dwarfs for preference, and no one is to come in without my permission, right?"
Colon's face contorted as various emotions fought for space. Finally, he managed to say,
"But poisoned? He's got food tasters and everything."
"Then maybe it was one of them, Fred."
"My God, sir, you don't trust anyone, do you?"
"No, Fred. Incidentally, was it you?"
"Just kidding," Vimes added quickly, as Colon's face threatened to burst into tears.
"Off you go. We don't have much time."
Vimes shut the door and leaned on it. Then he turned the key in the lock and moved a chair under the handle. Finally, he hauled the patrician off the floor and rolled him onto the bed. There was a grunt from the man, and his eyelids flickered.
"Poison," thought Vimes. "That's the worst of all. It doesn't make a noise. The poisoner can be miles away. You can't see it. Often you can't really smell it or taste it. It could be anywhere. And there it is, doing its work."
The patrician opened his eyes.
"I would like a glass of water," he said.
There was a jug and glass by the bed. Vimes picked up the jug and hesitated.
"I'll send someone to get some," he said.
Lord Vetinari blinked very slowly.
"Ah, Sir Samuel," he said. "But whom can you trust?"